Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett. And along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this biweekly news, commentary, and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. And you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett, plus exclusive content by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. One more time for y'all, become a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Right now we're live on Twitch, and you can follow the Numbers on Twitch at twitch.tv/the numbers. That's Numbers with a Z, the Numbers FM. So that's twitch.tv/the numbers FM. We begin each show with news stories that you might have missed, but should be on your radar. So without further ado, the news. First story comes from the Portland Mercury. It's titled, City Raises Concerns About ShotSpotter Gunshot Detection Technology. It's by Alex Zielinski. Zielinski writes, ShotSpotter uses a number of small microphones placed on streetlights, telephone poles, or other tall structures in city neighborhoods to detect sound that are akin to a gunshot. When that sound is registered by a microphone, ShotSpotter sends local law enforcement the general location of the sound for a quick response. The ShotSpotter company advertises its product as an alternate to police departments relying solely on 911 calls to be alerted to a shooting. One of the leading concerns among police accountability groups that oppose ShotSpotter is that it can falsely characterize a loud sound as a gunshot. That can mean a slammed car door, or a backfiring truck could, within minutes, bring a swarm of police to a neighborhood searching for a shooter. According to the ShotSpotter company, the technology has a 97% accuracy rate and a false positive rate of 0.5%. Measuring that against Portland shooting trends, the city estimates that ShotSpotter would deliver 66 false positive reports each year. Zielinski also writes, Smart City PDX analysis also pointed to ShotSpotter's tenuous record in the court. The report notes that Chicago is currently being sued for allegedly misusing ShotSpotter data, resulting in the death of a 65-year-old man. ShotSpotter itself is currently being held in contempt of court in Chicago for refusing to turn over documents on how it assesses the data it collects. So if you've been on, especially, activist Twitter, Portland activist Twitter, you've probably heard a little bit about ShotSpotter. You've seen some demonstrations, but again, we talk about the technology and toys going to police departments and what the city is spending its money on versus anything else. This is the latest battle in that. And some of you may be looking at the percentages and saying, okay, 0.5% is the false positive rate. Why does that matter? So again, by using the data, that would estimate out to about 66 false positive reports. That's 66 potential police involved shootings. I personally think that would be wild and way too much. And, never mind 66 are too much. So we'll keep an eye on this. Again, hopefully the city chooses to spend its money on anything else. Next story comes from the Oregonian. It's titled Floating World Comics Working to Breathe Life in the Lloyd Center. And it's by Destiny Johnson. So Destiny writes, and the hope of turning this strange and unique opportunity into something truly Portland-esque doesn't stop there. Quote, and then they would tell their friends, and I think the next part would be to bring in a really cool food court, said Le'Veon, not just your Subaru and Subway, but local chefs, restaurants, and food trucks to make a truly local experience in the mall from shops to the food. Independent shops like Le'Veon's Floating World Comics are looking to tap into that early 2000s mall rat experience of meeting up with your friends for a bite and shopping until you drop. So for those who don't know, Floating World Comics has been an independent comic shop in Portland for some time now. Used to be in downtown, most recently moved to Lloyd Center. And it seems to be part of Lloyd Center's move to kind of tap more into local businesses, which I think most of us would agree is an interesting idea. It could be a good idea. What I would note for people is that I think where this really started gaining a lot of steam was actually some years ago with My People's Market having a pop-up in Lloyd Center. For those who don't know, My People's Market is part of a Mercatus PDX project, which promotes businesses of color in Portland. And My People's Market is like a quarterly event that, you know, is a festival essentially with vendors, with music, with food that really kind of brings this to life. If you haven't been yet, I highly encourage you to go to them. But anyways, My People's Market started doing pop-ups in Lloyd Center a few years ago. One of the businesses that really popped off in there was Cultural Blends, which is sort of like a basketball culture brand type shop. Well, actually, I shouldn't say basketball culture. That's more of its spinoff. But I say all that to say it was so successful in Lloyd Center, it had a spinoff. And you had business owners of color and tenants of color who, even though Lloyd Center has kind of been in the news most recently as like, you know, essentially the story of the downfall of Lloyd Center is Lloyd Center closing. But you've had these businesses run by people of color that, like I said, have been kind of keeping the story going, keeping it at the very least on life support. So now that you see, frankly, white owned businesses coming in and you're seeing more momentum around sort of this local Lloyd Center strategy, I think it's important to keep a close eye on, you know, what happens with tenants of color who've been there or who have been looking at that. Because when I hear about ideas of, you know, expanding the food court, I think, ooh, I know a lot of businesses, specifically, you know, black and brown food truck businesses, food carts that would be great in there. I look at the businesses, you know, other tenants like the NAACP that are currently in there who, let's just say the situation with Lloyd Center management is tenuous. And I just wonder if, you know, as we go forward with this local movement to make sure that for all the positives, it doesn't leave tenants of color behind. So we'll keep an eye on that story as well. Next story comes from OPB. It's titled OHSU Social Workers, Respiratory Therapists, Others Vote to Authorize Strike. It's by Amelia Templeton. Templeton writes, Local 328 members of social workers, pharmacists, respiratory therapists, cleaners, and chaplains, among others, and make up about a third of the hospital's total workforce. The central disagreement is over pay increases. The union is seeking a 24% across-the-board wage increase for its members spread out over the course of 3 years. OHSU leaders have counteroffered 12% wage increase over 3 years. The authorization vote does not mean a strike is imminent. Per state law, the union will give the hospital at least 37 days notice before any strike, according to OHSU. So again, it's important as we look at a number of labor fights, we've talked about some of these stories most recently with Burgerville, but the, you know, wages are not keeping up with the price of inflation. Wages are not keeping up with the price of living. And one of the biggest factors in fighting against this is union representation and striking when need to. So at, you know, a place like OHSU, you were talking about, you know, mandatory workers. You're talking about, again, your pharmacists, your social workers, your respiratory therapists, your cleaners, your chaplains. And we need these people in the workforce. We need these people to keep our already kind of strained healthcare workforce moving. So hopefully this works out. Hopefully OHSU workers get what they need. We'll keep an eye on this story. Our last story comes from The Scanner. It's titled Dr. Robert Carl Hughley, February 27th, 1926 to August 4th, 2022. So this is an obituary about Robert Hughley, who made a number of contributions to the Portland community. Let me just share a little bit from this obituary for you. You're right. In the early 1950s, Hughley and his first wife, Mary Sharp, moved to Portland, where other relatives had come during the war. He was hired by Portland Public Schools in 1957, teaching at several high schools, while also working part-time for the U.S. Postal Service. After returning from a leave to earn his doctorate, he became the first African-American to administrate innovative federal programs such as Head Start, model schools, and integration programs for Portland public schools. During the late 1960s, he worked at Prairie View A&M in Texas and for the Southwest Regional Education Laboratory in Austin to initiate public kindergarten throughout Texas before bringing the family back to Southeast Portland and St. Stephen Parish. In 1972, he served alongside such Oregon luminaries as Edith Green, Vera Katz, Betty Roberts, and Wayne Morris as a delegate to the Democratic Party's National Convention in Miami. Hughley left Portland Public Schools in 1973 and oversaw special education programs in Inglewood and Palo Alto, California, then returned to Portland in the early 1980s, serving as tax collection manager for Multnomah County. In 1985, he became principal of St. Andrew's School. His entwined commitments to education, community, and his Catholic faith continued to be his focus. He was a longtime member and past president of the Albina Rotary Club, served for decades as a lector at St. Andrew Church, and helped the Christian Brothers LaSallian Education Corporation establish De La Salle North Catholic High School. In addition to serving on various boards and commissions, he was a vociferous fan and original season ticket holder of the Portland Trailblazers. So we send our condolences to Dr. Hughley's family, and it's very important just to, again, preserve this history and understand the people who kind of built the foundations for many of these things we take for granted in Portland. And that's the news.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break.
The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes.
If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the B Block. And we're gonna go into the movie world. Ado, have you seen the trailer for the? I want to say it's coming out in November. The movie Till.
I have not yet.
Have you heard about it at all?
A little bit here and there. Yeah.
Right. So, those who don't know, biopic actually on Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mother, is coming out later this year, and it's caused a lot of controversy on the internet, and it's very similar, same old debate people have been having for some years now about black trauma movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting for me because I'll be honest with you. I'm not planning to see Till, even though the director of the movies, done a number of interviews and said, like, he refused to take the project if he had to actually depict the murder. So in addition to it being about Mamie Till, it's also not trying to, literally depict the horror of the lynching of Emmett Till.
Right.
Like, he's been very clear about that. But nonetheless, you have a lot of people who've been very loud about, why does this movie exist? And why are we doing more black trauma movies? And it's bothered me, to be perfectly honest with you. And I say that as someone who has no plans to see this movie. So it's weird that I'm coming to the defense of it. But I don't know, our reaction culture, there comes a point where it's just like we're eating our own tails. And this idea of why should the Till movie exist when, we don't need any more black trauma movies, make something else. It's like, this isn't 5-10 years ago. Other movies do exist.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Emmett Till's family was very much not just a part of getting this movie made, but like, it's literally been fighting for years to get this made. So it's just kind of, it is disheartening to see people just for the sake of reactions, just, you know, poop all over this.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's, you could just as easily not see it.
Yeah.
There's everything else in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's, I don't know, maybe it's not a fair comparison, but to me it'd be like people getting mad at Ms. Marvel on Disney Plus for depicting partition. Like, we can tell all these stories. All this stuff can exist. And it's just like, as a, for the family, for the black creators, it just feels like an extra, like it takes so much to get anything made, to get anything produced and put out there to a mass audience, that you also have to go through this extra hurdle of your own people telling you this isn't valid. It's just, it's unnecessary. And just take it a step further, because I, maybe like a month ago, that I went to see Nope, you know, by Jordan Peele, right? Another black production. And you know how many people were in that theater?
How many?
Zero.
Huh?
It was just me. I was looking around like,
really?
Ooh, great. Well, no one's going to catch me in weird jump scare moments. So awesome. But also, because that's where I, that's actually where I saw the trailer for this movie. I hadn't really been paying attention. But, you know, they had the trailer for Till in there. And then, of course, I see the stuff on Twitter and all these other places. But, yeah, it's this weird thing where I'm trying to square people arguing about, we don't need any more black trauma movies. But when I go to, like, black other movies, I don't see anyone. And to be clear, I think Nope ended up still winning the box office for like 2-3 weeks. So, you know, Jordan Peele is getting his money. I encourage you to see the movie, by the way. Please do. But it's still, it's just these conversations, like I said, they can be disheartening. Where I just relate to something else, because we're talking about the Emmett Till movie right now, but it also reminds me of episode of Atlanta that came out this year about the, I mean, I'm not even going to say loosely, it was completely based on the story of the Hart family and these kids who were black children who were adopted by these two white women in Oregon who abused them. And eventually, eventually killed them driving off of a cliff, murder-suicide in California. It's an absolute tragic story. But yeah, Don Glover in Atlanta chose to basically like rework that into, I forget the words he used. You want to say like, I think you said a black fairy tale, where basically instead of everyone, you know, the entire family dying, the kids get out and it's kind of a happy ending, although it also includes a very questionable depiction of a black mother and there's some other stuff. And if you're already not a fan of Donald Glover, it's definitely the type of thing that would make you even less of a fan. Personally, I think it was a, you know, mostly a strong episode, although I think a lot of the questions with it are valid and whatever, you know, connection Glover and them made to, you know, surviving family members and all of that. I don't know. Like I said, there's legitimate questions there, but again, it kind of brings up whether it's Till, whether it's that, you know, the stories were out there, the news stories were out there, and I feel like I'm just seeing this uncomfortable reality where it's like we don't tend to care until these stories get their big spectacle moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's not, you know, a fun thing to say, but again, the stories like the Hart family were there. One of the children went viral because of like holding a free hug sign with a cop, and it got put into a photo op.
Mm-hmm.
And he loosely kind of looked like a young Aloe Black, and everyone got that. But again, it kind of passed by, and then Don Glover brought it back, and a lot more people engaged with the story and remembered it after that.
Mm-hmm.
But also a lot of people were angry about it. And it's like, again, I get the critiques of the episode itself and the approach to it, but what does it say that there was so much more engagement with it once it got dramatized?
Mm-hmm.
And now with this Till movie, you know, unfortunately, most of the people evoking Emmett Till's name that you hear right now are hoteps trying to compare him to Bill Cosby.
Mm.
And say, hey, you're just lynching another black, like wild stuff. So I feel like there is a scenario where at least even having this movie out could kind of like help recenter and bring context back to something to where this isn't just a throwaway, you know, where someone's tragic story is being used to defend predators.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But again, like I understand the emotions, but why we're crushing this film.
Mm-hmm.
And is the way we're crushing this film, we're just being real, is it because we're thinking about how white people will react? Because that's what I've heard in a lot of critiques where people said, yeah, I get it. You know, maybe it could raise awareness or whatever, but white people are going to go see this movie and then be like, oh, that's sad and terrible, and then go on with their days and it's going to last there. Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
That's how this stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean it doesn't have validity in being created? Does that not mean that, you know, beyond like a theatrical release, what it can be used in or used for doesn't have power?
Mm-hmm.
That Mamie Till's story isn't worth it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, we're crushing these things before they happen.
Right.
And why?
This movie
and for
has
what?
Not come out.
And it's like, if it really, you know, you don't have to see the movie. Like, mm-hmm. At the end of the day, go see Nope.
Please.
Go see these other things. Go, you know, go see whether it be, you know, Black and Brown Productions or even, you know, Black and Brown stories that are put into legacy franchises. Like, I think my favorite movie of the year right now might be Prey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is plenty out there for you to consume.
Right. Please do.
But I just find something really off when I say, when we basically do the calculation of, I can't do X because white people will do Y.
Mm.
Like, who cares about them? What about in our context? What about for us?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just, can we let Till be?
Mm-hmm.
Can we support the black creations we actually want to see?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I know this is it's a wild idea here, but what if we can have black everything? All the stories, all the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm posing some wild stuff here, but what if?
It's a great what if.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for my newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. We have a special guest in studio today, Joy Elise Davis, president of Imagine Black, or executive director
know, just person out here killing it in the world. How are you doing today?
You know, I'm doing okay today. I just talked to my mom. I haven't talked to her in a long time. I'm very fortunate to have AC during this heat wave. So yeah, I'm doing good. How are you?
Yeah, likewise. AC helps.
Yeah, it does.
It helps a lot. But yeah, I'm just doing good. Busy, you know, off camera. We had a little talk about some of us might need to schedule some vacations out here.
Yes.
Actually take some time because the work is good, but sustaining is helpful. But yeah, we've got a lot to talk about, but you know, there's always a lot going on with Imagine Black, but we've got an event coming up, so we gotta do the promo, gotta get into WWE mode here.
Do it.
So, as some of you may know, on September 14th, as a part of Oregon Humanities Consider This event, we're talking about Black political power in Oregon and what it means to build it, not just in our, I guess, respective silos, but you know, throughout the state. And yeah, I'll say, like, you and Imagine Black really inspired, I'm hosting this, by the way, I should also mention that Joy Elise is going to be one of the guests. We also have Marcus LeGrand from the Ben Lapine School District, vice chair of the school board, and Keith. God, no. See, we need a vacation.
I got you.
Names are I'm sorry, Keith, because we've talked multiple times.
Keith has a Black last name. It's Jenkins.
Yes, Keith Jenkins from So Black in Southern Oregon. So it's going to be awesome. It's going to be like a, you know, cross-geographical discussion. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I was actually introduced to So Black from Imagine Black. Just, I forgot, you know, in the many events you do, but I just, yeah, it put me on to that, put me on to kind of like some more stuff, you know, just happening in Southern Oregon and inspired me to investigate. But yeah, can you just talk about why seeking out peers, you know, doing this work in other parts of the region, knowing, you know, just with like driving with, you know, especially with like the pandemic now, you know, we don't have even less opportunities to, you know, link up in person necessarily, mm-hmm. but why still, you know, making those connections is so important considering the work you do.
Yeah. I'll go real personal and then go to the work. I think from a personal lens, this work is lonely at times. Like, you know, not so much even thinking about the numbers. And I know folks always have a lot to say, like, oh, there's what, just shy of 90,000 Black folks in the state. That part, I think, is exciting to me. Like, that's a really achievable organizing goal. Like, we can reach 90,000 people. But in terms of, like, progressive Black folks, there's not that many of us here that are outward about it. Some folks in this space are, you know, playing politics or letting politics play them, so to speak, and mm-hmm. having to downplay kind of their true stance and their issues. And it's nice to find like-minded organizations or folks who are willing to be bold, who's willing to, you know, draw a line in the sand and like, these are what I'm interested in. This is the issues that I'm passionate about. And this is the vision I have for the future. And I met Keith during Census 2020. We were working as an org trying to count with a bunch of other great BIPOC organizations, counting, you know, Black and brown and indigenous folks across the state, and met Keith and was like a little bit obsessed with his background and how he got to Oregon and his way of being. And I feel very fortunate to have kind of a local plug in that way, that we can kind of compare notes and energize each other when we're stressed out about this work, and have community, which I think is like super important. And this is not me bashing Black folks, but we know that, you know, not all skin folks are kin folks, and how we navigate with folks, it's important. And I think it's nice to just know that you have somebody that got your back. And generally speaking, there's just not a lot of Black organizations in the state that can do elections and political work. So it was cool to find one that was kind of aligned on some issues.
Yeah, we're going to double back to that elections and political angle, because that is very important. But what you said there just about the loneliness of this work just speaks to me. And it's,
you know, it's something that's kind of a theme with nonprofits in general, where, you know, you might look and say, oh, this group has X amount of volunteers or however many people on the email list. But so often, you know, it comes down to like, it's a small few doing several jobs at once each, and it burns you out. It gets tiring, and it's, you know, especially trying to do stuff in a place like Oregon, doing things like actually advocating fiercely for Black priorities. It just is draining. So yeah, making those connections, and I don't know, sometimes even just giving yourself an excuse again in the more traveling times to be like, yeah, I'm gonna take a drive down I-5, yes. Link up with these other people, and yes, enjoy, you know, enjoy the scenery of Oregon a little bit on the way to do it.
Yeah, it's nice. Beautiful. This is a beautiful state. Yeah, it's lonely. I mean, something you just said about doing so many jobs, you know, like Blacks, I'm like focusing on Black nonprofits, but there's so many Black folks operating without that like legal status, but are still doing so like amazing work. But we know just Black orgs nationally, we just don't get the same funding as everyone else. Mm. And then that number gets smaller when they're like organizing a progressive. I remember funders not that long ago in grant applications telling me we're not allowed to say the word organizing. Like, we couldn't say that. We couldn't say like educational campaign or like nonpartisan. The word campaign triggered. I know. Well, because the reality is folks get really nervous and fearful of Black liberation and even building the infrastructure to get close to it. And that same organization that, you know, will not be named, they've gone through some work, and now they let us say organizing in our applications. But it's hard when you're underfunded and you're tired and you are trying your best to dismantle a system that you also have to operate within. And like, I don't know. What I love so much about Black people in general, and, you know, you don't hear me always talk about Black people, but we can hold so many things, you know, like we can both hold that like this system is BS and ridiculous, while also holding the fact that we have to do certain things to move the work forward. And I think some folks will think that's a contradiction. And I think it speaks more to our genius and our able to navigate, to code switch, to keep our eye on the prize while also recognizing when something is just like far out wild, and that we still have to figure out how to have those complicated conversations. But yeah, this work is lonely and it's stressful. And sometimes when we make bold stances, people get pissed off, and then your number of kind of supporters gets smaller. And some people get upset about that. And for me, I get excited. I want to mess with the folks who are aligned with me, and I would much rather know up front than assuming that we're on the same page when we're not.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like that's a great segue into politics specifically, and that one, I'm sure some people may not realize that Imagine Black is actually a 501c4, and like 501c4, what does that mean? It sounds like, you know, nonprofit mumbo jumbo. But just to clarify, you have 501c3s, which cannot, you know, endorse candidates. It's kind of, I know there's other things about it, but
that's the big one.
That really is the big one. So, you know, Imagine Black in this most recent primaries put out its endorsements. It was, what, 19, 18 candidates throughout the state of Oregon, many of whom, you know, ended up winning their primaries. So, can you just talk about, again, like, why being able to, you know, speak, like, explicitly kind of, like, weigh in politics, not just on issues, campaigns, but on candidates, is so important. Yeah. Especially in a state like Oregon.
Yeah. I think it goes back to that, you know, just around 90,000 Black people who live in Oregon. We deserve so much more than what we're given. You know, we deserve better. And at a certain point, you hit a wall, I would say, within the current, like the popular 501c3 status. You're not allowed to lobby. You have to be mindful of how much you lobby, which means when you talk to legislators, you can only spend a certain percentage of your time on that. Like you're very much limited. And I think it speaks to the fact that like nonprofits were never designed to build power. They were never really designed for like liberation work. They were very much designed for white women to like have activities and funnel money through. But I think why political work is so important is that we need to be using all of the tools in our toolbox to get us closer to where we want to go. I don't think solely voting is enough. I don't think solely lobbying is enough. I think there's multiple strategies that you need to implement at the same time to get us closer. So for us, we believe that organizing, so that's not just, again, and there's no disrespect, not just holding an event, but actually trying to build power. And power that, you know, expands beyond just politics, power for folks to shape their environment. We talk a lot, I think, in spaces about like self-determination. But like, for me, that means being able to like shape your environment, being able to live, I guess, in its base, very basic format. I think I was looking at some quote by Huey Newton talking about like racism, like not really being so, not really wanting to focus on like the individual racism, like, okay, that person might be racist. But once they actually have the power to kill me because they're racist, like that is, and with no consequences, that is, it's that power piece. And I believe that Black folks globally, but focusing on Oregon, like we deserve to have power. We deserve to be self-determined and decide what our environment looks like. And organizing is both like a science and an art, and it is a specialized skill to move folks to power. So we believe in organizing. We believe in leadership development. I think leaders are they need to be invested in. And I think we see it even federally. We see so many folks, and this is not an ageist thing, but we see a lot of elders holding positions of power, but not passing it on to the next level. Like we see this constantly locally, whether it's like churches all the way up to like legislator, like it's in all these spaces. And there's many reasons I can critique why that's happening. And it's most basic, they need to just pass that power along and chill, you know? But also we need to invest in the next generation. Like it's not gonna happen overnight. It takes investment, it takes time, it takes political education, learning about this craft, and not just in like an academic setting, but like actually the stories and the lived experiences and that history that's not always taught in those spaces, but are taught in like nonprofits or taught in community groups. And then I think political power is alongside that. Like you need to have all three. You need to be able to go a step beyond just say, go out and vote. You need to actually tell people who's harming you. Politicians lie sometimes, most of the time, especially when they're up for elections, you know, they say what they need to say and their truth comes out when they're elected and they are actually like governing or making laws, so to speak. So I think it's important that when we do this work of politics, when we like are involved in it, that we create our own list of issues, our own list of demands, and we see if those candidates, how they can like, how do they measure up to that list, so to speak? Our politicians are meant to be pushed. They're meant to be held accountable, but they're not supposed to hold all the power. And I think if we can build the community power necessary, these politicians are working for us and not the other way around. I'm ranting a lot, but yeah.
Oh, but to that.
So, you know, to the, again, to any potential donors, funders watching for, whether it be Imagine Black or any, you know, people doing Black work, think about all the things we have just talked about and notice how none of those were teaching bias 101 to, you know, your white membership. I'm just going to throw that out
there.
There are things you could support that could actually be meaningful specifically to Black people, and it would actually be helpful. And you could feel better about yourselves too. Everyone wins.
Everybody wins.
Just throwing that out. Which also to plug Imagine Black Things, you have this might be a good time to talk about the membership and accomplices model, because it's an interesting kind of novel way of, you know, membership support for the organization. How's that work?
It's different in the sense that, I'll back up. Members in general, I always have a weird pit in my stomach And again, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to some folks when they have a group that they're representing in a space, but they actually are not connected to them. You know, they're not listening to them. They're not building community. They're not checking in. They're not holding who am I beholden to? Who's holding me accountable in these spaces? And what we realized, when I joined the org like 5 years ago, is that we actually didn't have this body, if I'm honest. We were like, we're not doing this work, and we need to figure out how to do it. And I wish more folks would be honest about our shortcomings and not let that stop us from like changing some things up. So we developed this membership program. We went through so many names, like, what do we call it? Because, you know, we like a good branding and like we like some art and stuff. And we landed on Kinfolk. We had another name that was not a great name, but a staff member was like, let's do Kinfolk. And it's really for Black folks who are like-minded to come together and help influence, you know, help us shape our elections. Like, when we endorse candidates, we ask folks to weigh in about, like, is this person for you? Like, what have you experienced with them? Are their words resonating with you? We ask them to help lead on campaigns, to help us decide what questions to ask candidates, like we did during this last primary session, election season. And then we developed a counter kind of space called the Accomplice Sustainers. And we went back and forth with it, if I'm honest. As a Black-led and a Black-serving org, we don't like to center people who are not Black, just to be real. Like, the only exception is that, you know, I try in my personal practice to center Black and Indigenous folks. And partly, too, is because I know Black people are Indigenous to something. We are the original people. So, like, to me, it's like, I see my kin as Indigenous folks as well, who are, you know, Indigenous to this land here in the U.S. But we were thinking, like, how do we actually get those non-Black folks who want to do more than just be an ally? And at the time, we were so over the ally word and branding. It was a way to absolve yourself from actually doing some work at times. Like, oh, I went to a training, pat on my back, I've ended racism now. Like, it's that type of energy. Or, like, I went, I cried, I realized racism exists, and now I'm stuck in this moment. We're like, no, like, there's actually work to do. We may not be the org that is going to help you untangle or recognize your own anti-Blackness. That is some other org's work. Kudos to them. They are doing it. We want them afterwards. Like, now that you've cried, now that you've gone through, you read, you know, your one book on racism or your two books or your three books, now what? And we're like, okay, we want to be a space for the now what. So we ask folks to join us as an accomplice, to go a step beyond an ally, to donate with us, to sustain the organization, to help us fundraise, to, you know, show up when we need you to show up. Because, you know, there's around 90,000 Black folks in the state, which means there are times we need our folks to join us in the fight. Like, we need them to put pressure on legislators who are not interested in listening. We need them to help replace legislators who refuse to listen or not willing to be pushed. We need folks to send those letters, to door knock, to protest, to be with us and not center themselves. And it's hard, I'm not gonna lie, and I don't think we get it perfect all the time. And I think we're dedicated, though, to like being better and not centering them, while also asking them and demanding actually that they join us in this way, behind us, but they join us in this fight.
Yeah. So this is gonna be dropping the first week of September. So, yeah, I know Imagine Black has a lot of things in the pipeline, but is there anything as far as coming up this fall that you'd like to put on people's radars, so, you know, yeah, they can participate? Ooh, join.
I love a good plug. So I think the first was already mentioned, what, September 14th? I'm very excited for this conversation. It's nice to be, you know, with my people or folks that I think, I don't know everybody, but people I think are my people, as we kind of talk about this space and hopefully agitate each other a little bit about dreaming a little bit bigger. So I'm like excited for the dialogue. We are actually, by the time this airs, we're actually bringing in someone on September 22nd, which I'm very excited about, and actually having some fangirl moments. Robin D.G. Kelly wrote this amazing book called Freedom Dreams, and it's the 20th anniversary. He's coming to town, and we grabbed him for some things, as well as this amazing poet and organizer who wrote the foreword is going to be there as well. So we're having a a space to do some political education and learning around a Black radical imagination. Like, what do we need to sustain us? What are the visions for the future? What this book that I think has influenced me and so many organizers and comrades of mine, it's just going to be a moment to kind of be in that space. So that's going to be actually in the building, Portland Art Museum, on September 22nd. And then my last plug is a little bit later in the year, but the elections, like November is a big deal. And I think for those who lean more progressive or liberal or whatever language, you don't consider yourself a conservative, I think we sometimes take for granted that, and we think Oregon is just this like bubble of liberal values. And like, I would say there's a lot of, you know, neoliberal values in this space, but there's also a lot of conservative folks. And like what's happening on the federal level, they are coming for people in this moment. They are coming for the governor's race. Like, the governor's race is actually a hot race. And I'm actually like, we got to double down on it, because I'm nervous, if I'm quite honest. And then also, I would say, leading up to the school board races, there's a lot of folks putting a lot of efforts in trying to push back on teaching our youth about the true, you know, the realities of this world, and lying to them. And, you know, whether it's like critical race theory or anything else, they're spewing lies their way. I think that we have an opportunity to make sure that this next generation is, you know, growing up with all the facts and the truth. And whether or not, you know, school board races are one of those races folks don't really get excited about, but it's so important. Mm-hmm. And same with our governor's race. So I would hope y'all register to vote, and I hope you're ready to, you know, put some work in this November, because I think it's going to take all of us to hold the line, so to speak.
Absolutely. I just want to double down on that, because, yeah, especially when you brought up school board, and whether it be critical race theory, whether it be, well, not even critical race theory, because that's not what these people are fighting against in the schools. They're literally just fighting on, you are acknowledging, like, Black and brown people, like, you're acknowledging history. How dare you?
How dare you?
Or, you know, oh, you are recognizing that, you know, trans children exist. How dare you?
Exist.
You think that having cops in schools is not a good thing. How dare you?
Oof.
I'm not saying that's a very personal LO fight I'm having right now, but LO school board, stop. Just stop. Anyways, yeah, like, it's just, I know, especially with like midterms, like you said, like, we take these things for granted. We're not paying attention. It's not the big sexy general election, but it's so important. And the people, you know, our opposition in these cases, they are organized. They take this very seriously.
They do.
At all these different levels.
That's how they maintain power.
Exactly.
Like, I know there's a lot of folks, especially in the Black community, I'm sorry to cut you off, who have been harmed by the government. I mean, I would say most of all of us have been harmed by the government, and sometimes feel like voting is just a waste of our time. It doesn't matter anyway. But I can tell you for a fact, this governor race, for example, for a lot of people, it's going to be the difference of how they are fed, how they're housed, how they have their needs met. These positions hold a lot of power, and it may not be the most liberatory spaces we can make them in this moment, but it is going to, our voting choices do actually impact a lot of vulnerable people. And it is a privilege to say that it doesn't matter. It actually matters to a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't say it better myself. Yeah. Joy Elise Davis, Executive Director of Imagine Black. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And this has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on The Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, Black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.